Okay, so let's start. So welcome to January, first of all. Happy New Year, belated Happy New Year to everybody. I know I did put it in there as well. I know we didn't do a call in December. December's a bit of a crazy month for everybody anyway. So I'm guessing everyone had plenty to get on with. Apologise in advance, got a bit of just the end of a head cold. So I might sound a little bit nasally on here. So today's live call. First of all, as always, just to say I am here to help. So if you've not taken advantage of the personal coaching side of things, then I am here to help you. Please do get in touch with that. Hopefully the people that have done it are seeing some progress up and down, but we're making progress overall, I think, which is great. So today I want to do is just a very brief update on the membership in terms of content. Then we're going to do our primary subject matter, which is strength training for runners, which is, well, it's a huge subject, one that I know is one that can be very confusing for everybody. It was confusing to me for quite some time. I'm probably not the best advocate of strength training for runners the traditional way, because I never really had to. And we'll kind of get into that as we go through. And anyway, and then we'll go into some of the questions. So lots of questions today, which is really good. So updates. So I've been continuing refining the neuroactive method, which underlies everything that running by design, or the flow of running by design, is built on. So neuroactive method, it will crop up a little bit through this presentation as well. But it's the whole model that I've been refining in the background to try and help everybody, runners and non-runners, basically get the best out of whatever their goals happen to be. And I think I'm in a place now where I'm proving it with people over the last sort of 6-7 months, and really trying to, I can see good results for people from all walks of life. And that's really good, because it means that from the membership perspective, I'm now starting to build that model in a bit more, so that we're, no matter where you are and you're running, you'll always have an approach to take that will help you get to your goal. And that's what Running by Design was really all about. It's about designing it specifically for you and obviously for your nervous system. So that's my approach. And that's what Neuroactive, as the underlying method behind it. It's also now it's up for trademark as well. So that's good. That's quite exciting development as well going forwards. New content for this month and next month. Continue with the podcast episodes. So if you haven't started listening to those, start off with the half marathon fatigue research, and we kind of build on that and go through that. That's really, I find that really interesting, because we're taking a real piece of research that was brand new in October. And we basically look at the biomechanical changes. So that's what the research looks at, biomechanical changes over a half marathon distance. And the researchers are looking at it from a biomechanical perspective. What we can then do is look at it from a neurological perspective, and we can actually explain those changes much, much better. So that's what the first few episodes of the podcast are all about. And then from there, I'll continue with that, and we'll kind of go down that route with taking different bits and pieces, and we just build it on. The content of today's call, I'm going to kind of flesh out a bit more and put into a specific course within the membership, specifically for strength training for runners. And as we go through today, then I'm going to bring out little bits that I'm going to kind of make a bit more detail on. And so that course is my goal, to have that done by the end of February. So you'll have something that you can get a bit of educational background on, and also have some practical applications of how you can use it. There is also an updated brain endurance training app, and I'm going to be writing a course for that. The app was actually written before the new year, the new version. I haven't put it out there yet, simply because I have to do all the help videos for it, the instruction videos, and actually that takes a lot longer than actually writing the app in the first place, just to explain it. It's very similar to how you're using it at the moment, for those of you that are using it. But it means the changes are, there's a different, when you first log in, there's a dashboard and it will suggest a session, but you can also choose your own session. I can also create specific playlists. So if I say to you, yes, I want you to do this after a run. So I want you to either do an RVIP test followed by this test, followed by that test. I can put that in a playlist for you, send you the playlist to your login, and you can actually load that up. So all you have to do is load it up and follow it. You don't have to set settings and set that. I can do all that for you in the background. So that's great. So that's a big improvement on the usability of that particular app. So anyway, that will be coming as well over the next few weeks. I've just got to do the help files for it, the help videos for it. But obviously on a one-to-one, I can explain how it uses, I can update the app as well. Okay, so let's start off with strength training for runners. Okay. So one of the big questions you have to ask when you talk about strength training, because it's everywhere. You do a search on the internet, you speak to coaches, you speak to other runners, speak to physios, and they'll all give you a slightly different angle on this. I think that's partly why it's so confusing. It's because if we think that we want to be more resilient, we want to be quicker, we want to run longer distances, then we have to be stronger. Okay. And there's a lot of logic in that. And traditionally, the way that we get stronger is by lifting weights or doing some form of resistance training. Now, hopefully, without banging on about it too much throughout this particular call, I hope to help you to think slightly differently. Okay. And that's not to say that strength training, traditional strength training, isn't important, because it is. But there are ways that we can achieve the same results faster, more simply, and much more efficiently without ever having to have a gym membership. Okay. So this will come clear as we go through. But first of all, one of the big questions we need to ask is, for running, what type of strength is needed? Okay. So you do a search on the internet, and and the things that come up here are pretty much what's accepted. So we need power. Okay. We need to be able to move forwards or backwards if you're a backwards runner. They do have competitions on the track for doing backwards running. There are some quite fast world records set for backwards running. Anyway, you need power. You need propulsion, and you need to be able to maintain speed. You need unilateral strength, because running is pretty much an activity of hopping or lunging from one leg to the other. We need strength on a single leg. And not just a single leg, actually. We need strength within one side of our body, although it comes cross-body when we cross over the pelvis. We need core stability. So we need controlled rotation. So we don't want to be having a whole body doing this. We want to have it controlled, but we do need some rotation, because that's how we move forward. Now, actually, when I looked this up to see what the most common types of strength were, it also said for spine protection. I'm only mentioning it because I think that's a bit of a strange one to be mentioned, because I've not really seen that as being something. But perhaps for some people, that is a thing. But I think that's something that people say because it sounds good rather than actually a requirement. But we do need muscle endurance, because we are handling the forces of running repeatedly. So the faster you go and the further you go, then we need to be able to have that resilience within our tissues. So it makes sense to have that muscular endurance. And then we need eccentric strength. So eccentric strength is where you are able to handle the muscle stretching under load. So if you imagine that we've gone through the gait cycle, it's difficult to do with your arm, but going through the gait cycle, heel is up, and then you're going through the swing phase where your foot is coming back through, then your hamstring is stretching. Okay, so your quad is contracting, your hamstring is stretching, but as it's doing so, you have to control that stretch so it doesn't just fly out. So a lot of the injuries that happen, hamstring injuries, is in that phase. It's not actually in the loading phase, it's in that phase. We can't control it as it comes forwards. And that's eccentric strength. It's basically resisting the stretch. Okay, so an eccentric would be loaded stretch, if you like. So we definitely do need that type of strength as well. Now, in all these cases, strength is an output. It's an output from your nervous system. So I like to call strength an expression of strength. And this will come clear as you go through as to why that is the case. But in the neurology world, we call strength an expression because it's an output from your nervous system. So we have to set that as the baseline, because the challenge is that most traditional strength training approaches it as the be all and end all. But we are treating it as the end of the process. Okay, this is the cake at the end of the baking. It's not the beginning of it. So if you want to influence the strength, you have to influence the bits before it. You don't just try and tackle the strength part of it. And that's a fundamental difference between somebody taking a neuro approach and a non-neuro approach. So then we have to ask, well, what's the best way to get stronger? If we accept that, yes, we need strength for running, and we do, and it's not just for running. If I want to lift this bottle of water, I need some strength. You know, to drink the water, I need strength. I need strength not just in the muscles that are lifting the bottle, but in my throat, in my diaphragm for breathing. You know, we need strength all of the time. But so we have to accept that, yes, we need strength for running, and we maybe need to, for the impacts load of running, we need the way we would normally understand it. We need a certain amount of strength. So what's the best way of getting that? Do we need squats, deadlifts, planks? Name your favorite exercise to achieve the strength for running. Because that's the second question we need to ask. Okay. And to determine that, we need to ask, well, what does running require? Not just from a strength perspective, but what does running require us to do? And we then say, well, do traditional strength exercises, you know, do squats and planks and lunges and all the great exercises that everybody does and recommends to everybody else, do they achieve what running actually needs us to do as runners? So we accept from a strength perspective that running requires power, and that requires muscular contraction. Okay. Sometimes it's explosive. So if you're a sprinter, you need explosion from your muscles to be able to do that. So you need fast muscular contraction. That's a different fiber type. When you start on the start line of park run and you go out too fast, that's explosive. When you want to overtake somebody, when you want to finish strong, that's that explosive type of strength, muscular contraction. But most of the time, as endurance runners being anybody who's not on the track, or really anybody who's not on the track or who's not doing more than kind of 1500 meters, then we need smooth endurance based muscular contraction. And that's a different muscle type, fiber type. So type one is the muscular explosive contraction, and type two, and we have what's not split into two as an A and B, we have the endurance based contractions. We also need joint stability. So to help reduce injury risk and to improve performance, we need to be able to stabilize our joints. And traditional strength approaches would say we need to do that by getting strong, by getting stronger muscles or bigger muscles around our joints to be able to stabilize a joint. Okay. So, and I use the phrase reducing your injury risk as opposed to injury prevention, because I don't believe you can prevent injuries. Okay. You can make your best efforts, but you're never going to be able to guarantee to prevent an injury, because it's too unpredictable. Okay. But we also need muscular contraction for joint stability. So we need our muscles to be able to contract in the right way to be able to stabilize a joint. We need tissue integrity. So we need our soft tissue, our connective tissues, to be functioning well. And in terms of things, we need good hydration for the tissues. We need the tissues to have the right messages going to them, as well as the structural integrity of that tissue. And running also requires good balance skills. Okay. And when I say balance skills, I'm taking the whole thing of balance together, the whole integrated action of balance. And pretty much everything else comes under one of these headings when we look at what does running require. So then we can simplify that down a little bit and say running requires muscular contraction at various intensities and speeds. It needs joint stability, which is muscular contraction, and relaxation. And that's so, so, so important. Whenever we do strength work, we're taught to create tension. Always taught to create tension. We're never taught to relax, you know, have that relaxation, that muscular relaxation within a gym environment. Well, I have never come across that. Yes, you might want to go to yoga for that, or you might want to do this for that, but actually we need to be doing it at the same time. We need to be contracting a muscle, and we need to be, as we're contracting that muscle, we need to be aware of the other muscles relaxing. We also need to, the muscle we've just contracted, we need to learn how to relax that muscle. Otherwise, what you have, and you see this, I see it all the time, is the runners who do a lot of strength work tend to be very tense. So their go-to for anything that requires stability is just to create a lot of tension. And I've seen this so many times over the years. It's very easy to create tension. It's very hard to create relaxation. But if you're tense, so if my arm is tense and I want to try and move it back and forward, that's really difficult to do. If I'm creating tension and relaxation, it's fluid. Running is a very complex set of actions across joints. We need to have tension when we need it, relaxation when we need it, so we can have fluid movement. If you look at dancers, they've got that down to a T. That's exactly what we want to emulate in terms of that fluidity. Okay. So joint stability, as we said, needs tissue integrity as well. But it also needs an awareness of where the joint is. So your brain needs to know where that joint is in order to stabilize it. Otherwise, it's you know, working blind. If you put a blindfold on and then pin the tail on a donkey, for example, that's what your brain is doing if it doesn't have a clear map of where a joint is. So it's not going to give you that muscular contraction. It's going to inhibit the expression of strength. So it's going to limit the strength that you have when you're running. So joint stability and that awareness of where the joint is really important. In terms of balance skills, we need visual skills, vestibular skills, proprioceptor skills, and then we need to have the integration between those systems. So basically taking a systems approach to it. That imbalance really needs all those systems together. And that alone, just this part alone, will give you a lot more strength than you can get going down to the gym and doing squats and planks if these systems aren't working well. Okay. So we can simplify it more. We say let's kind of zone in a little bit on this muscular contraction at various intensities and speeds. Okay, let's just see what does that require. So it requires a predictive model. Okay, so your brain needs to know what to do in the first place. So I need to contract a muscle, but it also needs to know how to do it. And it gets this through a learned experience. Okay, right from being an infant, you know, we're squeezing things and holding things and pulling things, and we're learning how much force to apply to things. We're learning how much we need to apply to move something so we don't break something. We do that throughout our entire lives. And I'm sure you've had lots of examples where you pick something up and it's been a lot heavier than you expected, or, you know, the converse, where you've picked something up and it's been a lot lighter than you expected. And that's updating our internal models of what to do. So the brain needs to have a predictive model, and it also adds on to that a best guess. And the way our brain works in terms of prediction is always a moment ahead of our conscious awareness. It's always guessing because it's never got the full information at any one time. So it can apply, unless you're doing exactly the same thing all the time, but life just isn't that predictable. There's an element of guess in everything. Now, we also have to have an element of muscular and motor control to physically be able to contract a muscle. So we need to have a plan and a prediction of what happens, and we have to have the ability to physically do it. Okay. Now, I thought it would be an interesting thing to do to emulate some software. So what if we had to write some software to do the brain's job of contracting a muscle, what would it need to know? Okay, so it would need to know about how much force to apply, how much torque to apply. And it has to make a prediction because it doesn't really know that ahead of time. Okay, it can use a model, but doesn't really know. It needs to know what the limits are around that. And it needs to adjust it for how tired we are. It needs to know the speed of applying that force. And it needs to know at every point of that joint angle. So if I were to contract my bicep, the force I apply here might be different from here, might be different from here, particularly if I'm holding a resistance strap, for example. So it needs to know that. It needs to know the position of the joint angle. It needs to know that all of the time. It needs to know the timing. When do I start the contraction? When do I end the contraction? Where, at what point do I ramp it up or ramp it down? You need to know any safety mechanisms around it. So what's the tissue integrity like? What can the bone withstand? So, you know, we hear occasionally about these stories where little old ladies lift up cars to save kids and stuff. Well, they don't tell you afterwards that, yes, she was able to summon all that strength, but she shattered all her bones in the, you know, by doing that. And that's because we have a part of our brain that actually inhibits strength. We have a lot of available capacity within our muscles already, but the brain limits it. And this is really where you get into the neuro stuff, as, you know, these limits are set for lots of different, you know, reasons. And a lot of that is safety and protection. Okay, we can't access the strength, the capacity that we have. And from a software perspective, it needs to be real. Muscles just, you know, don't turn on instantly. There is a delay within that as well. So before we translate it to code, I want to just show you this. So I thought it would be interesting to generate some pseudocode. So pseudocode basically is the English version of actual code. You can't put this code into a computer, but this would lead into it. So we have to have some structural models around what we're doing. So we have to have, this is basically just to move one, this is one muscle, okay? This is not even multiple muscles across. This is one muscle. These are all the things, and this goes on and on and on, so I'm not going to go through it all. These are all the things that the brain would need to know, or a piece of software would need to know, to contract a muscle. So it needs, it's all about all these joint angles and forces and everything we've just been talking about. It needs to know all about the sensory information coming in that also gives a lot of that information. It needs to know what the active controller state is. It needs to know, this is called a muscle tick. So basically, for every bit that the muscle contracts, it needs to update all of that information all of the time. Again, it's all this kind of stuff has to happen. And there are filters and things to validate the sensory information that's coming in. There's lots of estimates that are going on, and ramping protocols that are going on, and all the safety and protection mechanisms that have to happen in the background. And it has to convert it all actually into the force that's there. And it has to do this all the time. And it's just on and on and on, right? So that's very, very complex. And the brain basically has to do the same thing, okay? So your controller issues a motor command, that's the activation. It then produces a copy of that, and that copy contains the predictions of what it expects to come back in from the sensory information coming in. So if I were to move my right hand, I'm into my left cortex. So all of this part, this motor command, or everything we've just been talking about prediction, everything else has to happen up here. So that's the architect. It then sends that across down to my right cerebellum. Okay, my right cerebellum then sends that out to the musculature on my right hand or my right arm. And as that's moving, that information is then coming back to my right cerebellum. And then what the cerebellum has to do is it has to see if there's a difference between what's predicted and what the actual movement is, based on all of our sensory. This is why it's so important to have a very accurate map, what's happening actually out in the periphery. And that the difference is called a prediction error. And that prediction error allows the cerebellum to quickly formulate a correction so that we can move the way that the prediction wanted. But it also updates the model so that next time, and it gets really complicated here, but the next time we move, and when I say the next time, I mean the next tick. So if I'm contracting here, this is happening all the time. I can only predict this part of the contraction. The next part of the contraction is based on the feedback from the previous one and a prediction based on that one. So if you think about running, and we're taking it in running steps, this step is now predicted and the sensory information is coming back, which predicts what's going to happen with this step. But of course, running is so unpredictable, this step is going to be different from that one. And so it's continually updating. It's happening all of the time, okay? So all of this feedback is updating the beliefs about the load, the muscle readiness, safety gating, all of that stuff we talked about before. And that's just, again, this is a little bit of pseudocode in terms of what we have to have data structures, for example. We would build a data structure, have to have all these internal beliefs about what the estimated load is, what the delay, because the sensory motor delay on it as well. How long does it take for the sensory information to come back compared to me doing a continuous movement. And that's got to be part of the prediction. And then we have to have this forward model state where, again, we're predicting the next step. We're always predicting the next step based on the step that's just gone before us. And we're not consciously aware of that, but this is happening all the time. Complex. So we can see that we need to have at least joint position of speed. We need to know about the muscle length and tension. We need to know about, in terms of running specifically, ground contact and the load variances within that. We need to know about our balance system, our vision system, and our threat and safety system. And all that needs to be taken into account all of the time in every single moment that you're alive. So if we put that into like five steps, for example, we can say, okay, we decide the goal. And the goal is, let's say we're running. So we're running to just simplify it down to every step. Of course, it's micro than that, but let's just say every step. How much force or torque do I need for this step? How fast do I need to apply it? At what joint angle? And how stiff or stable must that joint be? Okay, and we're talking about joints. I mean, the foot by itself has just a whole bunch of joints in it. And then we have the ankle and the knee, la, la, la. Then we have to send the actual motor command. So we've not actually done anything yet. We have to send the motor command. We have to get the copy across to the cerebellum. And then what also has to happen is have these reflex loops in step three. So as well as the copy going to that cerebellum, there's another copy that actually goes down the left side. So if I'm moving my right hand, or say I'm landing on my right foot, I have to have a copy that goes down the left cerebellum, because what that's doing is a whole bunch of stability messages. And that's probably about 10 times more messaging going down that left side to stabilize my body so I don't fall over when I'm landing on my right foot. Okay. And now all that feedback loop comes in through two primary ways. Okay. We have a fast reflex loop through our spinal cord, and that's instant stabilization. So that's given that instant stability. So micro adjustments. So if you're running on trail, different terrain, you might have roots, but even on the road, you might slip off a pavement. You might, have to avoid a pothole or avoid somebody or not notice there's a car coming and change. Anyone who tells you running is predictable is wrong. It's so unpredictable. Even running on a treadmill is still unpredictable. Okay, it's probably the closest you can get to it being predictable, but it's still unpredictable as far as the brain's concerned. Okay, so it's having to do this all of the time. There is a system called the OODA loop, which Mark may know of. It's used in the military. It was invented in the Air Force during the Second World War. And it's about the fastest way of getting efficiency. So the brain kind of has an OODA loop, really. So we have this fast reflex loop that comes in, immediate changes, but then we have this slower cortical brain loops, that cortex down out through the cerebellum. And then this is what is updating the predictive models. Then we have to take account all these protection mechanisms, but then we have to learn about it and we have to update it all. So we know that running performance requires coordination. Okay, it's not just about raw strength, because we need the right force at the right time in the right position with the right joint stability and under fatigue and unpredictable conditions. Does a barbell squat train that? Which is probably one of the most popular exercises for runners. Okay, so let's see what a barbell squat trains. So it trains your nervous system to solve a very specific problem. And that problem is, how do I stop myself collapsing under a heavy, predictable vertical load? Okay. So first of all, does that sound like running? Probably not. There's some carryover. There's some. So I'm being a bit flippant, to be honest, because there is some carryover. We'll get into that one. So to solve that problem, we need to train maximum force capacity. Okay. We need to train load tolerance, structural robustness, confidence under heavy load, and slow controlled joint stability. Okay, now just reading that list, yes, there's some that can definitely carry over to running. And particularly things like, for me, confidence under heavy load is probably one of them. Okay. Load tolerance, perhaps, but we're going to explain that a little bit. But what a squat doesn't train, rapid force production, required for running, elastic energy use required for running, phase specific timing, So as we go through the running gait, we land, we have mid stance, we have toe off, we have swing phase. None of that's included. Reflex driven joint stabilization. Nope. Unpredictable load handling. Nope. But interestingly, and I will say this, we can modify every single, and this is what the course will go into, every single or pretty much every single traditional strength exercise that, that people are given for running, we can actually make it running specific by changing it. So if you want to make a squat unpredictable, other than not attaching the weight properly, which I don't recommend, you could use an aqua bag. Okay, so you could use an aqua bag. So it's now it's unpredictable. Now you have to keep the weight in one place without the water sloshing back. You have to stabilize in a very, very different way. Even better than a squat is doing walking lunges with an aqua bag or doing A skips, or A marches, for example, not skip. Well, maybe you're strong enough, but certainly marches you can do. I give them these to the kids. But I also, rather than just having it straight, sometimes I'll do it deliberately an angle. So they have to then stabilize in a different way. Or you could do around the world with our aqua bag. So we can modify traditional strength training to do that. But by itself, unfortunately, it doesn't do some of these things. So it doesn't do running specific coordination. Now, why does it matter? Well, because running requires your nervous system to solve a very different problem, which is how do I accept force, redirect it, and reapply it in less than 200 milliseconds on one leg while staying balanced and economical? So that's a very, very different problem that has to solve. And to solve that problem, it has to have low co-contraction. So co-contraction being more than one muscle contracting at the same time. Going back to the podcast, that half marathon research paper, that's what it looks at. It looks at what the biomechanical changes are over the half marathon distance. And one of the things I noticed was there was more co-contractions as that runner got tired. Now, the interesting thing about that research is there is recreational runners. So all these runners are doing the half marathon roughly about 2 hours. Just over 2 hours. So it's applicable to a mass population of runners at the moment. So they find that they have a high co-contraction as they get more fatigued. So that's why we can explain it from a neuro perspective. So we need precise timing to be able to solve this problem. We need reflex availability. So we need your fascial tissue and your muscles to be able to reflex. And we need a stiff spring that's responsive. Okay, it's not stiff in terms of tension, stiffness in terms of having resistance that reflects, okay? So like a shock absorber in a car or a big tough spring. We need joint stiffness that adapts by phase. So we need tension in some places, we need relaxation in other places, okay? We need prediction under uncertainty, okay? So we need to have good, strong predictive models when the whole thing is unpredictable in the first place. Which is why when I get people to do a squat, I get them to do it in straightforward fit positions, in positions, out positions, and every other position that I can get them in. Because when you land, particularly on trail, you might not land with your feet straight. You might land here, there, and everywhere, depending on what it's like, depending on how tired you are. So when I do strength work with people, all the strength exercises are adapted to meet the specifics of running. And this is why. Because we need to have really good models and maps. So if all that's the case and actually a squat doesn't really fit it, a standard squat without modification doesn't really fit it, why are they recommended? Well, squats improve capacity. And that does matter for running, or it may matter for running. I mean, it does matter, but it might not matter for you, okay, specifically. But capacity is not the same as expression. Capacity is having the available strength. Expression is using that strength. And they're very, very different things. Okay, a squat doesn't teach your system how to use that strength in anything other than a squat. Okay. Squats raise the maximum force potential of your quads, your glutes, your hip extensors, and your trunk stabilizers, primarily. Okay, other muscles as well. So what you're doing is you are getting bigger muscles. Okay. But here's an interesting thought for you. How many elite runners have big muscles? Not many. Very few. In fact, it'll probably slow you down. There are exceptions to that rule. But by and large, not many. Okay? So doing these exercises give you capacity. Question is, do you need that extra capacity? Or do you already have enough strength? Okay? So why is it that somebody who can go to the gym 3 or 4 times a week, get all this extra capacity, still has all these performance issues, has potential injury issues, is in pain, plateaus, all the rest of it, where someone like me, who's virtually done no strength work at all over my traditional strength work, over my running journey, has, you know, achieved kind of okay, and I'm still on an upward trajectory now. I come back from long COVID. So why is that? What's the difference? And these are the questions that I ask all the time. You know, why don't these things work? I'm not just on a soapbox because I feel like having a bit of an argument with somebody. I'm actually looking behind the scenes and asking the questions. So squats are also recommended because they improve tissue tolerance. Okay, and that really is important for running. But again, it's not the same as an expression of strength. Tissue tolerance being the resilience of the tissues being able to tolerate a high load over a high frequency over a high duration, okay? So squats improve tendon load tolerance, improve bone loading, joint compression tolerance, and importantly for me, confidence under load. Tissue tolerance matters in running because we have better recovery. We can tolerate a high mileage, and we can tolerate intensity sooner. So it means you can turn on the afterburners earlier on in a race, and your muscles won't be the point of failure. It'll just be everything else about you because you're going out too fast. But the muscles themselves will be fine. Again, gives confidence under load. For me, that confidence load is so important from an interoceptive perspective. Again, question, do you currently need that extra tissue tolerance? Because the sensible approach, if you're going to up your distance when you're running, is to do it progressively, okay? So if you're going, if you currently run 10Ks and you want to run a half marathon and you want to do it where you're not just run walking, I don't mean just run walking from a disparaging, but in terms of adding load to your musculature, okay? The reason why you'd want to go and do squats, for example, or some traditional strength exercises is because you want extra capacity and extra tissue tolerance, which would suggest you're going to go from 10K to a half marathon and run that half marathon at the same relative intensity as a 10K, i.e. race it or run it hard, which means you need extra tolerance, okay? But training for a half marathon from a 10K, you're going to progressively be doing longer runs and you're going to be progressively increasing your volume. That alone will give you the tissue tolerance. Why do you need to go and do squats? Running specific strength training is better than non-running specific training. That's 100% carryover. Okay, so long as you're doing it the right way. 100% carryover. So do you need to go and do this extra non-specific work? Where it does benefit people is if they've never done any strength training before, they're new to strength training, they'll get a benefit from it simply because they're doing, it's actually going to be the neural activation part of it, but they'll get that aspect out of it. But if you've done any kind of strength training before, doing more doesn't necessarily mean it's going to do you any good. Okay. So these are the questions we want. Do we need extra capacity? Do we need extra tolerance? Can we get that capacity? Can we get that tolerance a different way without having to spend out at a gym membership and spending time in the gym when we could be doing that, doing something else? And that's not to have a go. Some people love doing strength work and that's absolutely fine. It's not having a go. I'm literally trying to relate it back to strength for runners. Okay. So what does a barbell squat really does? Well, the first thing it does, it doesn't make you run strong. Okay. Unequivocally does not make you run strong. It makes it possible for you to run strong. Okay. So it gives you the capacity of the strength, but it does not give you the use of that strength. And you may already have all the force capacity and tissue tolerance you need for your running goals, or you may be able to get it just through your normal running. Okay. Just some thoughts for you there when we move on. So, what does running actually require? Well, it requires a systems approach. Okay. We need your visual system working properly, vestibular system, proprioceptive system, and the integration between your systems. And I know that's because that's what I believe in, but I believe in it because actually that's the best approach. And believe me, I've spent however many years getting to this point of being down one side and really coming across and realizing actually, if I look at my own running journey, what I've worked on, not really knowing what I was doing, was these things. And this is why I've never had to do very much strength work. And whatever strength work I do do is building on the foundation of having decent systems in each of these areas. And yes, I can keep on improving them, and I do keep on improving them. And when I do, I see big gain. Like, for example, I realized not long before Christmas, actually, keeping my head up, I tend to drop my head. So keeping my head up more, wow, all of a sudden, my running improved. But what I had to do is some vestibular training to ensure that that was staying up. And I have to just top that up every now and again as well. And then we make all of these things stronger by using brain endurance training. Now, that could be some of these traditional strength training exercises. So one of the things I always say to people is we can get range of movement really quite quickly. Okay, we can do some eye work, we can do some cerebellar work, and we can increase your range of movement like seconds. What would take, I don't know, a year of yoga practice. I can get people to touch the floor minutes normally. But to keep that range, you have to help your brain feel safe, and that is where some of the traditional strength training can come in, because I can then help solidify what you've already just done. Okay, so it's really great for adding on. But for me, it's the end of the process, not the whole process. And that brings us to the neuroactive process. So the neuroactive process, or approach, should we say, is very flexible in its nature. These are actual kind of like progression circles. I know it looks like a lovely little flower, but these are actually progression circles. So we start off with identifying the weakest signal. Or we could say identify a goal. Okay, either are the same. If we're doing specific work on somebody, I would say identify the weakest signal. We clean that signal up, then we train the system, we integrate with all the other systems, and then we strengthen it, and that gives us that capacity. Okay, so identify so we'll go through some examples, but let's just say we've got a bit of a sore knee. Well, we're identifying what the problem is. So we identify, is that a sensory issue? Is it a nerve issue? We clean that signal up. Then we train the system. So that might be we train, let's just say it's our visual system. So as part of the balance side of things, which affects the knee, we train. And I've got examples of all of this with real people in real situations. We train the visual system, and all of a sudden everything starts to work properly. Then we integrate it and strengthen it. But we don't need to follow all of these processes. It might be the first two are all we need. And suddenly you've got a lot more strength than you had. Because your brain feels safe, so it gives you the strength that you already have. Instead of holding it back and then you trying to force it to come out through doing traditional strength exercises, it's basically you clear the systems up, and all of a sudden clear the blockage up, and you've got the strength. And it can be as simple as that. So the process, I guess, to follow is, what do you want to achieve right now? Okay, so why do you think you need to do strength work? I guess is the way of putting that. Will a traditional strength exercise do this for you? And if you believe so, why or how? So we'll go through some examples. So have you started with the first two steps of the neuroactive method, i.e. identify and clean? And after you've done that, do you still need that strength exercise? And if so, is it for the same reason? Or are we then using it to solidify changes? So example one is handling longer distances. Okay, so that's one of the reasons that we're told we need to go and do some strength work, because we need to be more robust, particularly as we get older. Now, just as an aside here, it is very well recognized that doing weight training, particularly heavier weight training, is very good for bone density, bone strength, as we get older, tissue strength. Okay, so I'm not going against that at all. I think it's a really, really good thing to do. What I'm saying is we have to be aware of why we're doing what we're doing. Okay, so resistance training, particularly as we get older, is an incredibly good thing to do. But that's the goal, if you see what I mean. And that is a very specific goal that we would want to do. But we're not pretending to ourselves it's going to help us necessarily with anything else. So if we say, okay, we're going to handle longer distances, we need to be resilient. We know that. And we've been told that you have to then do that through traditional strength training. So will a traditional strength exercise do this for you? And if you believe so, then why, then how? Well, traditionally, we would say, we've been told, do some squats, do some lunges, do some Bulgarian versions or Romanian versions of deadlifts and things like that. And the theory behind it is it builds that capacity although they won't use that phrase, they'll say it builds strength so that when you're running, you'll have that strength going on. But unless you're doing 100 to 200 to 300 squats, it's not emulating running at all. You could do jump lunges for about an hour and a half, might emulate a half marathon, but you might as well go out and run a half marathon. So is there a carryover? So if you want to handle longer distances, have you identified why you can't currently do it? Why do you think you need to go and do strength work to do it? Or don't you? Is it just because someone's told you to? Because that expression of strength, when you start to get really fatigued later on in a longer run and you feel like you might not have that capacity, is it because actually you can't balance very well anymore? So your nervous system's got tired, your visual system isn't particularly great, or your proprioceptive system, your brain doesn't know where your joints are, and that is a really important one as well. These systems are failing, and therefore it stops you from having that strength. And all the research will tell us that that's what happens first. Your nervous system will fail before your physical system will. So if you're doing squats and deadlifts and lunges and all that other good stuff in the gym, thinking it's going to give you the ability to handle longer distances without doing all the other stuff around it, then you're mistaken. And anyone who tells you that doesn't know what that strength training is actually doing. Get the base first, get your visual system, vestibular system, proprioceptive system, and the integration between those systems up a level, then add the strength work on and you'll get more bang from your buck in terms of that, okay? So then you ask the question, well, do I still need strength exercise? No, not yet. I'm going to hold off for a little bit. I'm going to do all the work in my visual, vestibular and proprioceptive system, do some integration exercises, which may actually be some of those traditional strength exercises. And then if I really need to do it more after that, then I will do. Okay. The only time I really did concentrated strength work was in a build up to my proper sub-3 marathon that I did. And I did 12 weeks of one strength session a week. But I was doing coordination work, I was doing agility work, I was doing balance work 4 times a week. So example number 2, reduce your injury risk. And we've all been told this. To reduce your injury risk, you have to be stronger. Now, I'm not going to dispute that, but what I would say is we can get strength elsewhere, as I've just kind of pointed out. Okay. So if you want to reduce your injury risk, the traditional thinking is you need to have strong muscles. Again, I'll go back to you do lots of squat work, you do lots of deadlift work, and you at some point you have to keep on putting the weight on, or else you're not forcing any adaptation. Otherwise, what are you actually doing when you're doing it? You don't want to be a big muscular person trying to do lots of running unless you're a sprinter. Okay, so it kind of is almost going against itself all the time, really. So will a traditional strength exercise do this for you? Well, they will within that environment. So a squat will reduce your injury risk in doing a squat. A lunge will reduce your injury risk in doing a lunge, as long as you're doing it properly, you're learning it, you're doing it. But here's an interesting thought. Let's just say you're doing a squat or a lunge. And again, real life examples of this, of someone who does go to the gym, a current client of mine who goes to the gym, who when they first came to see me, when they were doing the lunge, they couldn't do the lunge with good balance. Okay. And that was holding them back when they were going to their exercise classes because they were doing a conditioning class. It was quite quick and they needed to do it. And it was uncomfortable for them because they couldn't do a lunge properly without falling. This is an unweighted lunge, just a bodyweight lunge. So the lunge wasn't teaching them how to do a lunge. How I taught them how to do a lunge was fix their visual system with a little bit of vestibular training. And all of a sudden they could do a lunge. So now we're using the nervous system to help them go to a gym class. That's brilliant. It's totally the opposite of what everyone will tell you. But now she can go and enjoy her, because she likes doing it. So she can go and enjoy her gym sessions and not injure herself. So, and this is a prime example. Have you done the first 2 steps, identify and clean? Then we ask, do we need to still do these strength exercises to help reduce our injury risk? Well, we might do, but at the end of the chain, okay? And then we could say anything. I need to strengthen my ankles, my knee, my hip, my whatever it might be. And we literally go through the same process. Okay. And we ask the same questions. And we always come out with the same answer. There's always something stopping you from expressing that strength in the first place. And by doing traditional strength exercises, you're trying to force your system to do that. It can work. And, you know, I'm sure there's lots of research that will say it does work, but it will take a long time. You increase your injury risk whilst you're doing it, and potentially you slow down your running, or you make your running worse. So, big question, are strength exercises doing what we think they are doing? And I think the answer to that is probably a resounding no, they're not. They're very specific to that exercise. There's virtually no carryover, and this has been shown time and again, which is why we have to modify them. There's virtually no carryover into a different activity, specifically one that's as dynamic as running. Could you achieve a greater expression of strength? Could you be stronger more easily and in much less time? Yes, you can. So I had to chuck this in. There was a kind of a last minute chucking this one in. And it's only because it was 2 days ago, I think, I saw this. And it came up on Facebook. And the Facebook post was, the press up is the do everything, no kit exercise for upper body, and maybe one of the best overall exercises you can do. It's an excellent indicator of muscular endurance and absolute strength, how strong you are for your body size, which is why it's a key element in almost all fitness tests. This is how many push-ups... The article then goes to say, this is how many push-ups you actually need to perform to start seeing some noticeable results and why it's important to running. So, that's an interesting one to look into. Let's go and investigate that particular claim. So a press-up is very good at improving relative upper body strength. Yep. Strength relative to body mass. Particularly for pushing muscles, pecs, triceps, anterior shoulder. So if you run like this, it might be a really good exercise for you. Okay, we just kind of do this. That's really, really good. It's not training arm swing. Okay, it's not even in the right plane of motion for an arm swing, but, you know, it's good. And the reason why it shows up in fitness tests is because it's standardized and it's easy to repeat. That's why it shows up in fitness tests, because we can benchmark you now, and we can benchmark you after you've done X amount of weeks of training. That's why it turns up. Same as a squat does, same as a bleep test does, these things. Because they're standardized and they're repeatable. Not because they're effective. Not because they're a good measure of anything. And this was this is why I don't post a lot, I guess, because it just frustrates me, this kind of this approach to it. But anyway, moving on, it does also it teaches trunk stiffness under load. Okay, so you're doing a press up, a bit like a plank, I guess. A good press up will have your trunk resisting extension and rotation, okay? And your system learns to maintain a rigid torso while your limbs move, okay? So rigid torso, limbs moving, that's not what we want for running. We need to have a amount of rotation. And you can see people who do a lot of this type of work when they're running, because they're the ones who are very stiff and create a lot of tension to be able to support an upright posture, rather than having a dynamic, relaxed, loose posture, which is what you need for running. Okay, so yes, press up can support posture, it can support force transfer, and it can support general robustness in doing a press up and doing activities similar to a press up, but that doesn't carry over for running. Ooh. And it can train muscular endurance locally. If you're doing high rep push-ups, the nervous system learns to tolerate sustained contraction in this motion, and for your toes standing up if you're doing it barefoot. And it'll do fatigue resistance improves for that specific task, okay? Again, it's really useful if you like doing press-ups, okay? Useful for social media. But what it doesn't train is specific arm swing, timing, counter-rotation between pelvis and thorax, okay? So we need that disassociation from upper body to lower body to have fluid movement across that. That's how we move forwards. We need elastic energy transfer. We need reflex-driven trunk stabilization. So we need to have, so this is going back to the walking lunges with the Acrobag. We need to have that reactive stabilization. So you're much better off doing that type of thing. Again, we could change the press up. So as you're doing a press up, you've got somebody who's pushing you side to side. You have to stabilize it. Do walking press ups and having somebody disrupting you. You have to stabilize it. Do a combination of a press up and a kind of a Superman where you're having to bring your arms and legs in and stabilize. And I do that people occasionally where I use a laser and they have to keep the laser aligned up. So they have to keep rigidity, but they have to keep fluidity across the movement. So things like that, you can adapt all these exercises. As we need that coordination under impact and under fatigue, and particularly running, fatigue features very heavily, particularly as we're kind of doing longer events and longer runs. And of course, we need to be phase specific stiffness, which a press up just does not train. It's specific to running. Okay. So the context is completely different. And within the article itself, the UK Athletics level 3 coach, who they quoted him in the article, basically, his claims rested on three areas. Upper body and core strength matter for running. Yep. Posture affects efficiency. Correct. And the press up challenges core stabilization. Yep. All correct. Okay. And posture matters as well. Okay. Because poor posture can increase energy cost. It can alter load distribution. It can contribute to fatigue related breakdowns. But the posture in running is not a held posture. Okay. It's a continuous reorganized posture with every step. It's very, very dynamic and it needs to be fluid. If you're holding yourself rigid, then you're increasing your injury risk and you're reducing your performance. Okay, so all the things that he quotes as saying that these things matter, they matter within a specific context, and that is not what a press-up trains. Okay, so I'm not saying press-ups are bad. There's no exercise is good or bad. It's just whether it's specific enough and helpful enough for running. Is there a better way we can get the same effect? And yes, there is. So press-ups improve general strength, trunk strength and endurance, which can support the posture, okay, if the nervous system then knows how to then adapt that for a running environment, okay? So you could do some press-ups and then you could do some other dynamic work, come back and do a press-up and do some dynamic work. So you're learning this. So it's all about adapting what you have. Just doing press-ups and expecting that to carry over to a dynamic fluid posture is wrong. It's incorrect. It's misguided, shall we say. So without that second step, that stiffness the press up gives you can actually increase your vertical oscillation, so the amount that you are running up and down, and that's very energy inefficient. Okay, it will reduce your trunk rotation and it can blunt your arm and leg timing because you're creating so much tension. You're more robotic. Okay, so you're not fluid, and that affects your timing from your arm to your opposite leg, and that affects everything else as well. And of course, it raises the energy cost. I believe it also increases your injury risk because of that. And your joints react differently when you're full of tension and all this kind of stuff. So some runners, they feel strong but tight after the type of strength training, and that's because that's what it's doing. It's teaching you to create tension without teaching you relaxation. So we're going to move on to our questions now. But before we do, let's just come back from that question from Julian. Does anybody have any questions? A bit of a rant, but hopefully a useful directional rant to get you to think about, is what I'm doing actually achieving what I want to do? And is there a quicker, better, easier, more efficient, more specific way of doing it? Questions, anyway, before we move on to the main questions, any questions about that specifically? Nope, that's fine. Okay, so we'll move on to the questions that were submitted. Thank you, Julia, for these ones. So could strength training have the opposite intention, make me worse at running, injury risk aside? And yes, it can do. It wouldn't surprise you to learn that. So you probably get that from what we said already. It can do if we can't then reintegrate that strength in a running specific context. So if we're not adapting some of the strength exercises that we're doing, yes, it definitely can. And it's not because that strength is bad. I don't really believe there's any bad or good exercises. Is how you use them and whether they're appropriate for your goals. I also don't think in terms of execution, in terms of form, sometimes what some people would class as poor form is actually really useful form. You know, if you're only doing a squat like up and down like this and you're trying to use it to teach yourself, or that's how we move, if you go to pick something up, you're going up and down like that. Most people don't. So, you know, this whole thing about knees over toes and this, that, or don't knees over toes, don't do this, don't turn this. I get people into all different types of squat positions because that's life. That's what we have to do. We have to have the predictive models. Okay. We've got to be careful about load, obviously. Okay. But your brain learns how to use force based on context. Okay. So predictive models, we're building models. And if we're always doing our strength work in the models that are dictated by that exercise, then we're not doing it in a running specific context. It learns that safety, that capacity, that use, that expression in that context. It doesn't put it outside that context. So it can also affect your running if it changes how your brain solves the running problem. Okay, so strength training doesn't just change your muscles, it changes your strategy, which is kind of just what I said pretty much. So sometimes that strategy will work under a barbell, or the one that works under a barbell is the wrong one for running, and most definitely. Lunges are definitely closer to that, for sure. And lunges with an acro bag turning, doing some turning as you're doing it is also closer as well. So we can modify, but generally speaking, most people who go to the gym, they're not going to do that. They're going to do these traditional strength training exercises, and they're training for a different problem. Okay, they're solving a different problem. So yes, it can affect your running, most definitely. So the brain doesn't train muscles, it trains solutions. So the brain reuses familiar force strategies even when the task changes. So if a way of producing force feels safe and successful in the gym, the brain will naturally favor that strategy even when the task changes. For example, when you are running. But it won't use it as a whole, it just use bits of it. And that's just may not be very helpful. Some bits will be helpful, but a lot of it won't be helpful. And that's where the problem starts, because we start to have some carryover in terms of tension, because we feel safe when we're tense, but it doesn't have the desired carryover in terms of what we think it's doing in terms of giving us that ability to use that strength, that expression. So excess stiffness in the wrong phases. So you're strong, but you're less springy. Tension. And you'll see it next time you go out for a run and you see people running, spot the ones who you can probably guess do a lot of strength work, and you start noticing it. They're the ones who create a lot of tension. They might not do strength work. They might also have vestibular problems as well, because that's one of the ways we get around balance issues, by creating a lot of tension. It's a safety mechanism, basically. So the incorrect or non-carryover strength work can give you delayed or blunt reflexes, heavy strides, and efficiency decline. That'll probably ring some bells with some of us. I see this as well, particularly people who and I notice it, particularly if I take out a group, the differences in people, and I can see the people that do these sorts of things. And then we have this overprotection under fatigue, that thing about when we get tired, we create tension. And I know some of you know what I'm talking about here. And it's a go-to. Tension is a go-to for the nervous system when we want to protect everything. We're wired for flexion. So as soon as we start to get tired, we start to create tension. We might end up in a hunched over position, but we will be in a hunched over position, tense, not relaxed. And then it's that tension is then used to create that co-contraction. So in that half marathon research paper, what they found was that as the feet and ankles fatigued, the runners started to recruit more of their glutes and their hamstrings, the bigger muscles, the bigger postural muscles, more of their trunk to help stabilize them. That affects performance. It reduces it starts to lock up the peripheral joints because it doesn't need them as much and it can't control them as much because of that fatigue. And that's kind of what the brain starts to do. We have this guarded movement and a loss of rhythm. And then we have a coordination mismatch, which is why you see some people coming across the finish line of a race, even at 5K, even at park run, are a complete mess. And because all this has fallen apart, because the only way they know to keep it together is by creating tension. And when that doesn't work, because they're too tired, they're kind of all over the place. Okay, we can address that in a neuro way, much better. Yes, these are all the forces showing up at the wrong time. They have tension in all the wrong places. So hopefully that answers that question. So as I mentioned before, strength training can help people if they're under strength. If you don't have that capacity already, then strength training will help you. Okay. And that's why people who just suddenly start strength training, if they're not injuring themselves first, tend to have really good gains, because because their nervous system's reacting to that and saying, oh yeah. And the first actually 6 weeks of that is not actually creating muscle mass, it's releasing that inhibition on the muscle. It's activating all those motor units, because the brain is very efficient by its very nature. So if it doesn't need motor units to move, then it will switch them off because they use energy. So going down to the gym and doing stuff activates those motor units. And the confidence that it improves. And for me, that I say, that's one of the biggest things I see. So problems arise when the strength increases, but the movement strategy doesn't evolve with it. Okay, so we just rely on that strength exercise without modifying it, without trying to put it into a running context. And that's why some runners can get stronger but slower. And I know there are some examples. Some people will be smiling as well, listening to this. And I see this all the time. And again, you might feel tight or flat after a gym block, particularly then if you go and try and run, you know, your legs feel heavy, you feel wooden, etc. So strength raises your potential. Running decides how much of that potential you can express. Okay. Or your nervous system does within a running context, let's just say. Okay. Do we have any comments on that at all before we move on to the next question? Nope. Cool. So again, from Julia's question, what's the single best thing I can do to reduce injury risk other than not run? Okay. So if you'd asked me this maybe about 10 years ago, I would have said some of the normal things like look at your technique. I think I probably also would have said, and I think I have done, I mean, I've worked with some people for a very long time, so I've always gone on about coordination, agility, balance. I've always done that right from the very beginning. But I would probably say things like looking at your technique, which I'm so much less on these days because that tends to look after itself now once we get the other thing else sorted out. Still important, but it's lower down the priority list. And I probably would have said to a certain element, you know, strength or get stronger. Not necessarily understanding the best way of doing that. Now, however, I would say improve your ability to adapt to load rather than just tolerating it. Okay. And that's quite a kind of, I suppose, an ambiguous statement to make. But when you progressively increase your distance, you're improving your ability to adapt. When you're training your visual system and your vestibular system, you're training your ability to adapt to load. All of this is helping. Doing some traditional weight training, yeah, that's also helping as well. But everything else that you do around the direct goal of improving your ability is just helping to improve that adaptation. So any strength work you do, mobility, shoes, drills, any recovery tools that you use, they're just helping to improve that adaptation of itself. Okay, so they're all the tools, all the methods, but the actual one thing you can do is have a goal of improving your ability to adapt to load. And that starts off with systems integration. Okay. Running injuries rarely happen because a muscle is weak. And this, again, comes down to capacity. Most of us already have the capacity to run well. We don't need to be doing a load of exercises that give us more capacity. What we need to do is learn how to use it. And injuries rarely happen because a joint is tight. Tight joints or tight muscles as a contraction, it's a protection mechanism from the nervous system. It tends to happen because something else is wrong. Okay. And it's most running injuries tend not to happen when a tissue suddenly fails. Of course, there are the face plants, there are the people who fall off a curb. That does happen, but that's not the majority. The majority are progressive. Progressive tissue injuries are, I'll stick my neck out a little bit here as well. It's progressive, turns into pain and a niggle way before there's any physical injury. So we think we've got a running injury and all we actually have is pain. Because pain is the brain's red alert to something isn't right here. Do something about it, or you will have, or you may have, I predict you will have, a tissue issue. Okay. So most running injuries, and this is what, when I really started to look into a lot of the self-reported running injury statistics out there, most of it is running pain. They're not running injuries. Most people have pain way before they have any kind of injury. So all these research papers that say that, you know, patella pain and, you know, runner's knee basically, and pain in the ankles and ITB injuries, all these injuries are the top injuries. I can pretty much, I think anyway, my belief is they're all just pain. There's hardly any tissue issues amongst any of that. Okay. So this isn't why injuries happen. Most injuries happen because the load changes faster than the system can adapt. Okay. You can't balance well. Your systems integration isn't there. So when you go off the edge of a curb or you slip over a route, you can't react to it. Unconsciously, you can't react to it. You don't have a good map. All the sensory mapping that needs to happen. If that isn't in place, that's why injuries happen. Okay. Or the load is applied in a way that system can't organize efficiently enough to be able to handle. Same thing, pretty much, just in a slightly different way. Okay. That can also account for acute injuries as well. Because if you face plant, then the load is certainly applied in a way that your system can't organize itself to do anything about, unless you have an airbag or something. But basically, that's why injuries happen. And you can reduce your injury risk by training the systems that enable your overall system to work in that way. Visual, vestibular, proprioceptive integration. So your injury risk drops when your system can sense the load accurately, sensory, mapping, distribute the load well, cerebellar function, adjust strategy when conditions change, again, cerebellar function and cortical function, and recover and update between runs and sessions, overall system. Okay, so it's a control problem, not a strength problem. So the best single thing that you can do to reduce your injury risk is to improve how your nervous system coordinates and distributes load whilst you're running under fatigue and changing conditions. Okay. Predictive models, mapping, brain function. And then you add the strength work on top of it. Okay, so sensing where the load is going, adjusting stiffness by phase, so running specific drills and exercises. A lot of the elites, specifically the Kenyan elites, they do virtually no traditional strength training at all. None. What they do is lots and lots of running specific drills, lots of A skips, marches. You look up Kenyan running on YouTube and you'll see they're all coordinated. So you'll have about 20 of them doing the exercises in a very coordinated fashion, as if they're dancing. This is what makes you resilient, lowers your injury risk in running. Okay. It's not going into the gym and lifting weights. It's doing all the stuff that supports the sport of running. Okay. Consistent running combined with good coordination and adaptability reduces injury risk more than any single exercise or strength program. So hopefully that's helped to not just confuse things even more. Because it brings us back to the neuroactive model. Again, this is why this model kind of works in any situation, absolutely any situation, because we just go through the process, or even the first two parts will work for a lot of situations. So the next question, also from Julia, would it be possible to have the calls recorded as audio, as this would be easier to catch up on? Yes, hopefully. Actually, splitting the audio part out by itself is the easy part. The hard part is finding a platform that isn't going to cost me a fortune to host it on. That's the difficult part. I'm going to look and see if I can do it on Spotify, but I don't know if they have limits on the size, the length of a file that can go on there. But and if I can protect it so it's just you guys who can watch it rather than it being public, then I'll do that. But I will investigate that. So yes, absolutely. And I know that's a lot easier because I listen to a lot of podcasts and stuff when I'm walking the dog or in the car. That's how I catch up with a lot of stuff. So I will definitely investigate that. Next question is from Erica, who I'm so pleased to hear that she has got trainers on, has been out the door again. And she's saying, I'm following a couch to 5K plan, so keeping my increases in time and distance small. Good, exactly what we've been talking about. Number one goal, adaptability. What would you say would be the number one top tip, just said it, that you should keep in mind to help this becoming something you can sustain? Well, keep doing what you're doing, basically. Enjoy the process rather than focusing on the outcome, okay? It doesn't matter how long it takes for you to get through the program. If you have to repeat weeks, doesn't matter. What matters is you enjoy the process, okay? Look for all the positive improvements that you can, no matter how small they are. Notice slightly less tired on this run, or notice, oh, actually, do you know what, feels a little bit better. Even if, oh, notice, actually, I don't feel the need to walk, even though the program's telling me I need to do this little bit of walk. I don't feel I need to. I will do, because that's what the program is telling me. keeping my adaptability, but to notice those small things, keep it enjoyable. That's what I would say is kind of the number one thing. It goes back a little bit to the motivation stuff we talked about in the November call. Find the stuff in there that allows you to progress and keep your engagement in there. And then Erica also asked, do you have any good advice to keep her from getting injured? Yes, improve your ability to adapt to load, not just tolerate it. That is the number one. And I'd say take your time. Don't be in a rush to progress it, okay? You're doing exactly the right thing by following that program. And when the program finishes, even if you repeat it, but just do it, repeat it in the sense of progression, obviously, get in touch, part of your membership. I can help you progress that in the same style, okay? That's look after your systems, of course, visual vestibular proprioceptive and the integration between those systems, okay? And I know we've spoken about that at length, particularly visual system. Look after those systems, and that will then help you to feel more engaged and feel like you're making more progress than just the plan by itself. And the final one from Erica, also, if I'm only completing up to 5K, do I really need to pre-fuel? No, would be a simple answer. A complicated question, really, if you really delve into it. 5K, no, you don't need to pre-fuel at all. And in fact, it can work in your favor to not have anything to eat for a couple of hours beforehand, just in terms of general metabolic flexibility and adaptation. So you could do it fasted. 5K, the fatigue you're going to feel is not from a lack of fuel. The fatigue you're going to feel is your nervous system getting tired because you're having to focus. It's having to release an expression of strength to get you through that 5K. It's not a lack of fueling. Okay, so you do not need to pre-fuel. What would be really good for you is to do some brain endurance training on the app. Let's see if I can share. Aha, am I logged in? Right, let's just log into the app. This is the New Look app. This one here. So it recommends a session based on what you've been doing beforehand. But you can choose different sessions, lots of sessions, as I can send individual sessions as well. But let's go into advanced coaching tools. So what you could do to help any fatigue that you do feel is when you come back in from doing a 5K session or from the character 5K session, you do some brain endurance training using the app. And you might want to use a flanker test, for example. So a flanker test is one where you have to, if I just start, you'll see. So what we have here in the flanker test, we have arrows, and I've got to choose the button that corresponds to the middle arrow. Okay, so we go right, we go down, we go right, left. And basically, the longer this goes on for, the more fatigued your brain is going to get. And it's teaching it to, that was obviously a short one because of the test, it's teaching it to have focus and attention and adapting to cognitive load under fatigue. And this can really help in the latter stages of your run. And I do mention that in the last episode of the podcast, we go into this a little bit more. We have other tests. I mean, there's tons of tests. Stroop test, the inhibition test. There's loads of it. So if you haven't, I haven't given everybody access, but if you've messaged me, I'll give you individual access to it, to the actual app itself whilst I'm writing the course to do that. Okay, let's go back to the presentation. So no, you don't need to pre-fuel, but some brain endurance training I think will help you a lot. And actually post-fuel, 5K, if you're a bit tired, probably not even that. If you want to have something, just have something normal, you know, just have some normal slow-release carbohydrates. This whole thing about carbohydrate window and protein window is highly debated. So just stick to your normal routine. I don't think you need to, you know, do anything. Even if it's taking you, it's time on feet, so it'd be taking you quite a long time to do it. So think about the time aspect of it, but you just want to stick to whole foods. Okay, you don't need anything special. Don't need any gels or electrolytes. I think are always helpful. I think people underestimate how much sodium and potassium and stuff that they need. So maybe a little bit of electrolyte before and after, but other than that, I wouldn't bother about the fueling side of things. At this stage, I wouldn't worry too much about. Okay, so that's it from me. Does anybody have any questions? Yep, feel free just to unmute yourself and ask away.
I don't know whether it's relevant for now, and I'm just catching up on the course, so you may have already covered this. Apologies if you have. But you were mentioning there about injuries and some injuries not being injuries, but actually pain. So, you know, last year I had a lot of issue with IT band and down to my knee, and didn't seem like there was an injury. Took some rest and that went away. What that pain signal, what's that trying to tell me? That pain that I am feeling, it's, you know, in my brain, it's I need to stop running. So I'm just trying to understand, if it's not an injury, but there's pain there, then what is that pain signal doing?
Okay, so first of all, it's not, although it's easy to talk about pain signals, but it's a threat signal.
Okay.
So we don't have, and the course in the membership to look at is there is one specifically on that. So it'd be useful to go over that. But basically, we don't have any threat receptors in our body. We don't have a pain center in the brain. So we don't have any pain sensors. We don't have a pain center. What we have is free nerve endings called nociceptors. And those nociceptors detect threat.
Mm-hmm.
So more kind of simply put, if you like, if the brain detects a threat, one of the easiest ways of it telling you there is a threat in the system is by producing pain. And that's because we pay attention to pain. But that pain might not be anything to do with where you experience it. So the originating issue might not be in your IT band. Okay. Mm-hmm. You might be experiencing a pain around that area because, I mean, it could be the tissues are irritated. So it could be nerve related, and that's the threat. And what your brain does, it creates an experience of pain. It might be that actually your brain can't stabilize your knee properly. And so therefore the forces on the IT band tissue, I mean, it's tight anyway because it's very thick band of tissue, it's designed to be like that, but if that's where it is, then the experience of pain then is a threat signal to say I can't stabilize your knee. The problem with pain is it's quite often very non-specific.
Mm-hmm.
And to add more complexity to that, now you've had that pain, depending on how long it went on for, pain mm-hmm. is a skill, so your brain learns how to express it. So if you then have a lot of stress in your life, for example, and your brain wants you to slow down, it might give you IT band pain.
Mm.
But it's a signal of overwhelming threat, not of the fact you've got a tissue issue. And that's where you have to have the separation. This week, it's so complex. Mm. But modern pain neuroscience, it's very clear that pain and injury is almost a coincidence. They coexist because the injury is a threat, not because the injury is causing pain. Because there are plenty of people who have pain without injury and plenty of people who have injury without pain. One of the great examples from Professor Mosley is a guy walking down the street with an axe in his head, and he had experienced no pain whatsoever. He even went into, on his way down to A&E, he even went into the corner shop and bought a sandwich and carried on down. And then when he was in the hospital and they were taking his notes, he turned around and banged his knee on the low table that was there and was in absolute agony. And, you know, just a really good example. It's a real example as well. That's just the way pain works. So pain, it can be localized. It can indicate a localized issue. Of course, tissue issues do happen. Of course they do. But quite often pain, particularly if it's chronic pain, is an indication that there's another threat. In my experience, particularly with active people, it tends to be joint stability. Somewhere it's joint stability. So you look at teenagers who have growing pains, osteoarthritis latus and severus is the heel, osteoarthritis is the knee. It's where the growth plate grows. Yes, there might be some tension on some of the tissues. I get that. But actually, it's because the brain no longer knows where that joint is. So it can't stabilize it. So when they're trying to use it, it's unstable. That's a massive threat. So we talk about strength. It just doesn't give you any strength. Instead of what it produces pain, because it says, I said, I don't want you in this situation because you can't stabilize that joint. So it could well be that with yourself, there was something there that happened. Now, why rest resolved it? quite often rest doesn't resolve it. So in your case, that was great that it did. Quite often you actually have to resolve the bit, whether it's the visual system or vestibular, whatever it might be, sensory system. Quite often I find with joint stability, it's the sensory system. Skin stretch is quite a big one. It's why physiotape works, not because it supports the joint, but because actually it's giving sensory feedback of where the joint is. So in your case, that was great that rest. Maybe there's a bit of overuse there, and the threat was that the tissues weren't having recovery time. So therefore, that time you took back actually reduced that threat. But basically, to answer your question, pain is a threat signal.
Okay.
Sometimes not necessarily very specific about why. That's the unraveling bit. That's the detective part you have to kind of do sometimes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, but yeah, the pain course in there, and you can always ask me more questions. Any time, just message me or whatever, any questions about that.
Sure do, thank you.
I think that's really, can I just jump in? That's quite an interesting point you made about stress. So, as Chris knows, I've been having a problem with foot pain for the past couple of months, and Chris has been helping with that, and it's been getting better. And then Chris asked me at the beginning of the call, he said, how's it been? And I said, oh, it sort of went bad again. I had a very, very stressful day, Wednesday, Thursday. And my foot pain last night and yesterday afternoon last night was really bad. It had gone bad again and I was really down about it, but I'd had an extremely stressful day. And then this morning, things have calmed down a bit stress-wise and actually the foot pain's been a lot better today. So there's definitely, for me, and I think in the past as well, when I've suffered with knee pain a bit in the past, and it has definitely, when I'm quite stressed in my life, I think it doesn't help that when I'm very stressed, I throw myself into exercise. So I'm kind of asking for trouble. You know, I'll go and do a really hard run to deal with the stress at work or in my life. So I don't think that helps as my way of dealing with stress. But also, I think for me, there definitely is a link between pain and stress. So it's interesting you saying that to Erica about stress.
Cool. Yeah, that's really helpful, and that's really good to note that it comes back to that whole threat bucket analogy. Which, I don't know if you remember, I reckon you might know that, but basically, it makes you imagine a bucket, and it has a level in it, and it has a tap, a certain level. And we can handle a certain amount of capacity of threat at any one time. And these are threats coming in from everywhere. Absolutely everything we do in life, you know, whether it's exercise, too much, too little, nutrition, life stress, work stress, all of it. And when it gets up above a level, then we have all these undesirable outputs flowing out. So in pain science, they say pain, but it could be fatigue. It could be autoimmune disorder. It could be, you know, skin conditions. It could be whatever. It doesn't matter. It's all triggered by the brain's desire to reduce global threat. So that's what it's trying to do, immobilize you to or stop you from doing something, get you, you know, to try and do that. And interesting with what we're doing with Julia was a lot of sensory work on her foot. So what you might find, Julia's doing some more sensory work on that foot now, might help just calm the situation, because that's now also an input signal to the brain to say, actually, that helps calm it. So you might find in times of stress, you have to stroke your foot.
I just yesterday thought oh, my foot's never gonna be better, none of this is working, I'm really fed up, but I hadn't made the link with what else was going on in my life and why it was particularly bad yesterday. I just see the things, and even though you said that thing about the bucket to me before, I'd forgotten all about that. So yeah, interesting, that's quite a helpful point. And yeah, it's been loads better today and it's things have calmed down, so yeah. Good. Interesting, really interesting.
Cool. Anything else? What was that interesting about the strength, or was it just a bit of a rant?
For me, do you want me to answer that?
Yeah, please.
I knew exactly what you were going to say. So for people that don't know, I do a lot of strength training. I absolutely love strength training, and I'm not going to change my strength training. Well, I might adapt my strength training. I'm still going to strength train. I don't do it for running. If it benefit, I worry it's, I think the relaxed bit's very interesting, because I think you'd agree, Chris, that that's probably part of my problem with running. I am very tense, and the strength training probably has that I do, probably hasn't helped with that. So it's interesting for me to think about, but I love strength training. but it's how can I still love strength training, still get the other benefits I get from it, but maybe help my running a little bit more and not be a hindrance to my running. So yeah, it's given me a bit to think about.
Yeah. And the relaxation.
I guess, sort of, Erica, you do a lot of strength training as well, don't you? We talked about strength training. We both love strength training.
Yeah.
So I don't know, do you kind of, what do you think, Erica?
I changed my, it's quite interesting, I actually changed my approach to my weight training last year with my PT, because last year my goal was to focus on running, which I've never done before. And I had a good year last year and I improved a lot in my running. Now, obviously, I was doing more running and focused on doing more running, so that will obviously have improved my running. But I also wasn't chasing PBs on the bar. And I wasn't doing all of the heavy squats and deadlifts. I was still doing some, but I wasn't pushing for PBs. And actually, I was doing more or less all of my training was unilateral. And going sideways, we were doing a lot with my balance, because my balance is very poor. And I am going to get on the neuroactive method and start looking at that, because my balance is still not great. But we were doing a lot of sideways work, so more dumbbell stuff rather than with the bar, and moving sideways and diagonals. And so, because I still love strength training and I love feeling strong, but I think that shift in how I was doing it probably also helped with my running year last year, and I'm continuing to do that this year. So that's, I'm still going to continue to train that way.
Yeah,
that's good. And that,
I think,
yeah, so you're kind of getting the best of both worlds there as well, which is great. Yeah, so we'll, yeah, just message me and we'll have a look at the balance side of things. We'll train it from, we'll support what you're doing already.
Yeah.
And I think that's important, Julie, that, you know, you enjoy strength training. As I say, it's not to take away from that. It's just maybe how can you support it? How can you complement it, you know, by doing, working on some of the other things, so that your strength training isn't just about creating tension.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not quite sure how to do that, but yeah.
Well, we can talk about that. That's fine. That's it'll be just making sure you're also doing some of the visual work, the vestibular work, doing some relaxation work, and maybe doing some of it either before or during some of your strength training as well. So you can, and that will enhance your enjoyment of the strength training, because that will go better. Although I know you like to, that's probably a lot, big stress release for you as well, I imagine, as well. So, but having that, having some of those exercises go more fluidly might help you enjoy that side of it as well.
Yeah, no, it'd be interesting to get your help with some of that. Thank you.
Cool. Any other questions?
I think it's interesting, Chris, that the three of us on this course, although I don't do any strength training per se, but my job, effectively doing strength training indirectly, but the three people that are on this link now all do some sort of in-depth strength training, or have done. And it would appear that all three of us, I know I certainly am, are very stiff, non-fluid runners.
Hence the reason why I took that approach on the call.
Yeah, I can see that. And the discussion tonight, the program you've given me gives it more background to it. Why we're actually doing that?
Yeah. Yeah, good. And it is really important just to have that fluidity. And I think it's just really important to just keep in mind what your goals are. And my goal for running was always to run. I was always to try and run. I mean, I like running to my ability in terms of speed and potentially endurance. And so it was never about being, you know, it's never about the aesthetics of a, you know, somebody who goes to the gym. That's never really overly appealed to me. And so I think it's just about what your goals are. And it's very difficult. As I say, there's no, sports science is now showing us carryover doesn't really happen. So you have to make exercises sport specific, whether that's, you know, for weightlifting, whether that's for so specific strength training, whether it's for running, tennis, it wouldn't matter what it is. You have to adapt what you're doing. And if you're trying to do two things, it's like training for a 5K and a marathon at the same time. Really hard to do.
Yeah, I get that.
Cool. Excellent. Well, good. I'm glad it's made you think. And that's the purpose of it.
I've got to be honest. Obviously, my first run was on Tuesday, and I was disappointed because I don't know whether you'll probably still say that my body is still too rigid and it's not coordinating properly, however you want to word it. But is there something psychosomatic about that I start running and think, ooh, that pain's coming back in the hip? Can it be psychosomatic that you're actually believing that you have got a pain even though you haven't?
Yeah, I wouldn't even class it as being psychosomatic. I'd just say it's a predictive model. You have a very strong model that you've built up over the last several months that you're expecting a pain in your hip. I mean, that is a definitive predictive model. So as soon as you start running, as soon as you put that into context, that's what your brain is expecting. And it's just going to take time to teach it. And self-talk can help with that a lot. So rather than the predictive model making you think, oh, I've got to be really cautious here. So actually, hang on a minute. Let's do a quick body scan. No, absolutely everything's all right. Don't need to worry about it. Let's just keep going. And the more you do that, the more you reassure your brain. And, you know, self-talk is really important in terms of, you know, talking, convincing your nervous system, because you are your nervous system. So although you might sound a bit, you know, woo-woo, what you're doing is you are in that, by that very nature, giving your brain safety. So you're kind of you are soothing your brain in that moment. I do that all the time. I went out for a run. Oh, this morning, today, I actually managed to get out for five. I've had this cold, so it's been horrible. And of course, a week skiing, I didn't do any running for a week. So when I came back, and skiing for me is such a low aerobic, like 0.5 aerobic, nothing. It's like doing nothing for a week and then eating and drinking. So, you know, I put on even the volume I was doing. So. That first run back, and when I stepped out the door and started my first few steps, my left ankle and foot shooting pain all the way up. Now, I know when I'm a little bit overweight, if I'm tired, if I haven't been eating and drinking very well, the first thing that happens is I get pain in my foot. And I just said to myself, oh, this is ridiculous, carry on. And two steps later, gone, isn't it? And it didn't come back for the rest of the 8K. You know, because I have a predictive model, it's a protection mechanism that my brain has that if it thinks this is going to be a hard run, that tries to stop me straight away. And I just tell it, grow up, get on with it, and it does. Obviously, if it was genuinely something wrong with my foot, it wouldn't have gone away. Just to say, you can't override pain, you can't just switch it off like that. Some people can kind of good at it. But, you know, so you do have all these predictive models running all the time. So you've just got a very strong one about that pain.
Right, but I find that so much. I really struggle to do that, because there's a part of me, like say Mark with his hip, me with my foot or my knee. There's part of me saying there's something really wrong with my foot. So the part of me that's saying, "Come on, Julia, get on with this. It's nothing." There's like an argument going on with myself, and I there's a bit of an, I don't know about you, Mark, as well. It's kind of this niggle. I've just lost my headphone. There's this niggle thing, there is something really, really wrong here. I need to stop. I find it hard to have that conversation with myself because there's two sides of it. And I don't, you know, although I don't think there's anything much wrong with my own, I'm pretty sure there's nothing really, there's no real injury. There's a doubt in my head that there could be a real injury.
And I think
I'm doing myself damage. And that's why I'm still sort of struggling with it, I think. Do you understand? I don't know if I'm making
sense. The only surefire way of knowing that is to go and get proper scanned on it. That's it. And otherwise, you're kind of guessing. It might be an educated guess, if you can't get rid of that discussion in your head about it, and you're convinced that there might be something wrong, then the only way to then get that brain safety is to go and have a scan. and someone to tell you, look at the scan. I mean, that doesn't always work either, because people can point, oh, it's degeneration, which is completely normal and not linked to pain. Either way, it's not linked to pain. I just say the other thing is, even if you had your foot hanging off, it's not necessarily linked to pain. You might not want to run on it, but so we're talking about, so, and this is where the confusion or the waters get very muddied. But if you think that there might be if part of you thinks there might be an underlying issue, the only way to resolve that is to make sure that there isn't. That there isn't kind of any other way around that. You either accept that you have a very low risk of that being the case, or you go and get it checked out to make sure it isn't. To see what
I mean. I think I've accepted that there's a very low risk of that being the case, because I know, you know, doing that light brushing of my foot makes the pain go away. So that the part of me says there cannot be, you know, rubbing my foot gently and the pain goes away. Well, there can't be anything particularly serious going on.
So I suppose then the question
at this stage, going and getting a scan is really, I understand what you're saying, and I know that really that going to get a scan now is pretty pointless, really.
So then I suppose
I
then
need to find a way of trying to have a strong, yeah. I don't know.
What's the worst that would happen?
Thing, isn't it?
Yeah, what would the worst that happen if you just ran on it? And just convince, and if you got a little bit of pain there, say, well, I'm just going to run through it and see what happens.
So I do, and that's what I do, and there wasn't really any pain. It's the next day. It's either later, a few hours later.
Okay.
But I'm running very tense.
Yeah.
Which is part of the, but I, you know, I can run and it doesn't hurt, but I know I'm quite tense when I'm running. And then I'm fine after the run, and it's hours later or it's the next day. I then get out of bed the next morning, I'm like, oh. But I didn't feel that run, and I didn't feel that right after the run. And then I kind of think, I can't run for ages, so I haven't run all week because the following day, and then I've had a stressful week and it sort of started hurting again. Yeah, sorry, I don't want to go with anything into all of this now. But yeah, when you're saying it's that kind of argument in your head, what Mark was talking about.
Here's another thought for you. If you're running with a lot of tension, particularly in that area, could the aches that you feel the next day be a result of basically DOMS? Because if I hold my bicep like that and I hold it like this for an entire run, I'm only going to expect that to be sore the next day.
So what is a bit sore the next day?
Because you're holding so much tension in it. I'm not saying it is. I'm just chucking out an extra thought here.
No, I imagine that is the reason.
So therefore, the solution to that is
doesn't
to
help.
Reduce...
It still hurts.
No, but what I'm saying, the discussion in your head then changes from the discussion in your head is more about relaxing the foot. So the instruction to yourself is relaxing, is about relaxing it.
I know. I understand it. It's just so hard to do in practice. Yeah. I think that's it. What about you, Mark? I mean, because it's not totally different issues you're having, but.
No, it's not. I totally get where you're coming from, because I started to run and I got halfway through the session on Tuesday and I suddenly thought, oh, how's my hip? And as soon as I thought, how's my hip? Oh, that's painful now. Oh, and then I was going through the internal dialogue in my head. No, just keep going through it. Just keep going through it. No, it's getting worse. Oh, it's getting, I'm never going to be able to sort this out. And it just, yeah, I'm quite, I haven't got much mental capacity, what with everything going on with the move and what have you, which has been very stressful and what have you. I was trying to be positive about it, but it, you know, as the session went on, it was just like, oh, am I ever going to sort this out? And it was, yeah. So I feel exactly the way you do, Julia.
And that's really just going to be, I think, a bit of practice. A little bit of practice.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm outside of that running environment.
Yeah. So I'm sure, because I say, although work's been a bit light this time of year anyway, but the hip had been a lot better. I hadn't noticed anything. And I start running and it's there and I didn't, yeah. I know what you're saying. It's, I've something in my brain's telling me that I'm running, so I've got pain, and I need to de-link that. And hopefully, with the program that you sent me, when I get in fully into that, hopefully that will help. But certainly reduce, hopefully relax, help me relax in that area. If even if I can just relax in that area to start with, just so I know I'm not overloaded on that one side or whatever.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then as you progress, we can address that anyway. So, cool. Good. Anything else? Nope. Everyone happy?
Yeah, I'm good.
Erica?
Yeah. Hey, thank you very much for answering the questions. That was really helpful. And I will definitely be taking on the motivation and thinking all the positive thoughts after each of my tiny, tiny runs.
Good, good. How long is it taking you to do a session?
So we've only been doing like interval runnings in terms of like a 90-second run, a 90-second walk. I've now got up to a 3-minute run, a 3-minute walk, and it seems to only be like 30 minutes. Okay. So getting to like 3K with my pace. I will be doing park tomorrow because fortunately our volunteer roster is amazingly full, which is great, but it does mean that I can't volunteer to run. But I run walking and try and concentrate on my breathing because I still panic about my breathing quite a lot. And also it's really interesting listening to yourself, Julia and Mark, with what's going through your brain when you're running, because I constantly think I'm going to fall over. Like I visualize falling over, not at the time, in fact, when I'm walking, to be fair. But I've been trying to really recognize, like, well, I haven't fallen over yet, and I don't think I'm going to in a minute. But even if you think I can see that I'm going to, it's like, yeah, but I haven't yet. So it's almost reinforcing. You have the thought, and then finding the evidence to support that that thought isn't true. And kind of keep going with that. So that's my plan at the moment. I don't know, how does that sound to you, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I probably mentioned it when we talked about the motivation bit. Years and years and years ago, when I did one of probably the best personal development programs, and it kind of still exists in some forms, and it was about 30 years ago, more than that maybe. And he said that one of the phrases that has always stuck with me is when you have that thought come in, he says, delete that program. Delete that program and you immediately replace it with a different way of thinking about it. So you think, oh, I'm going to fall, delete that program. I'm really steady on my feet. I'm really stable. So you just reframe it to positive.
Mm-hmm.
And that can just, again, you're updating your predictive models. Of course, I didn't know any of that at the time, but that's exactly what it's doing from on a neurological thing. So rather than, so you don't necessarily need to look for the evidence that you're not doing that. You just tell your brain, delete that program, and then you replace it with something unruly stable. Tell your brain what you want it to know. That's another way. That's how we can use it for anything. In any aspect of your life. Should you have this thought going in that you don't want in there, delete that program, replace it with something that's more constructive.
It's weird because I do that for my sea dipping thing. So obviously the water right now is really, really cold, but we never say, oh, the water's really cold. We go, it's not quite warm enough yet. This water is a bit warmer and then it'll be much nicer. So we're always having that positive spin on it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't say I'm tired, I could do with some more energy. You know, it's just reframing it slightly. Yeah. Awesome. It's a more gentle way, sometimes of approaching that. But, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris.
Excellent. Well, thank you all very much for attending. And obviously, the ones I'm already helping and coaching through, we'll continue doing that. The ones that haven't been in touch yet, the ones who keep on promising, Erica, and do something. Another Erica, you as well, please get in touch. So we just, that's what I'm here for, here to kind of help you move forward. And if you've got a particular subject for the next live call that you want me to cover, please let me know. And I'll kind of start looking into that. I say I'll keep on adding content to the membership when it comes up. The brain endurance part of it is really exciting, that app. So I do need to get the new version out there. But I say I need to get some help files. For the ones that aren't using it, just get in touch and I'll give you a login for it and just show you how to use it, basically. Okay. Thank Wonderful. You. Well, enjoy it tomorrow. Enjoy your weekends.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Chris.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks. Bye. 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 Bye.